Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Wednesday, September the 29th, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, a look at some of Keir Starmer's speech in the closing day of the Labour Party conference in Brighton. And something that you really must listen to from the mother of Sarah Everard. That and more coming up next. Hello and welcome, dear listener. It is Wednesday, September 29th, and thank you for listening. I want to just get straight into this, and you're going to be hearing from someone who has been at the forefront of fighting for justice in the UK for almost 30 years now, and this is from the Labour Party's political party conference that comes once a year in September. And this was today, and this episode is going to be largely about what happened at the Labour Party's conference on the final day of the conference today. And here now is Doreen Lawrence. Make that Baroness Doreen Lawrence. I will tell you who she is, for those of you who do not know, right after this clip.
Hello, my name is Doreen Lawrence. I think you all know my story. Like so many of you, I've spent my life fighting for people to get justice they deserve, campaigning against racism, helping to ensure that young people can fulfill their potential, trying to build a better country. About 15 years ago, I met Keir Starmer. He was a lawyer then. He was known for being on the side of ordinary people. Even back then, he had good hair. Keir's always on the side of families who deserve justice. He took the decision to prosecute my son's Stephen's murderers. It meant that finally some justice was done. Keir's been a friend to me ever since. Through my campaigning, I've met a lot of people who talk a lot. But Keir is someone who listens and acts. That's why when I said I could be his race advisor, he said yes. Because I knew it wouldn't just be about talking, it would be about changing things. He asked me to investigate the impact of COVID on minority communities. I was shocked by what we found, how black communities were badly affected by COVID because of the inequality in our society, how people's health was so badly impacted by the discrimination they faced, how inequality made the pandemic so much worse. Keir didn't just read my report. He said, this must lead to real change. And when I'm Prime Minister, it will do. That's the sort of man he is. And that's the sort of Prime Minister he will be. Someone who doesn't just believe in justice, equality, security, and opportunity, but someone who just work his whole life to help people to get them. I'm proud to call Keir my friend, and I'm proud to work with him as leader of the Labour Party. And I'm proud to introduce him to you now.
That was a heartfelt speech by Baroness Doreen Lawrence, OBE, Order of the British Empire. Now look, Doreen Lawrence, for those of you who do not know, and you, those of you outside the UK who may not know this, and some of you in the UK may not know this either, but I can't imagine you wouldn't know this. Dorian Lawrence is the mother of Stephen Lawrence. Stephen Lawrence was murdered in 1993 by some white youths, white men. And Dorian Lawrence, as his mother, has campaigned now for 28 years to get justice for her son. And the police have, you know, had largely turned a blind eye and a deaf ear to her and activists like her in the process, this long process of trying to get justice for her son, Stephen, who was brutally murdered. I mean, the police didn't do jack about it. They didn't do it. I mean, this was just so evil. And they've kept fighting now for 28 years. And I have to tell you, I do not know what the latest state of play is, for lack of a better terminology, of what's going on there. But I have to say, hats off to Baroness Dorian Lawrence. I mean, to go through this so publicly as she has for nearly 30 years and maintain the kind of personhood that she maintains and the leadership that she brings, I mean, this is really not something that anyone who's lost a son or a daughter or any family member should have to be doing in public. But again, as we do so much as black people, we have to fight our battles in public because of the way we are treated in public and in private by this society. We have to do this because if we don't do it, who's going to do it? If not us, whom? And so Dorian Lawrence has campaigned for justice for more than half her life, or half of her life, if not more. And here we are. So I thought that was a very nice speech as she was introducing Sir Keir Starmer, or was about to. And Dorian Lawrence is a very important figure in England and in the UK. I really think so. And to you, Mrs. Lawrence, Baroness Lawrence, my deepest condolences, and I also say a prayer to you too and for you, and thank you for your continued campaigning. And I support you and Stuart Lawrence, your other son, and your whole family 1,000%. And we must keep campaigning for you and with you and alongside you for Stephen. Because I'm sure that's obviously what Stephen would have wanted. And it's a shame that he's not here. So, in fact, it's so interesting. I actually knew someone named Stephen Lawrence. And when I first heard about this brutal murder, I actually thought it was the Stephen Lawrence I knew. I mean, I think that's kind of perhaps ancillary to this conversation and maybe very selfish of me to invoke that. But I was really wondering if it was the Stephen Lawrence that I knew, and then I found out it wasn't. But still, that didn't make me any less sad. Welcome back. And so now the first portion of the speech. And it's a very small portion. I'm not going to play that much. It's around 6 or 7 minutes, just under seven, roughly 7 minutes. The first few minutes of Sir Keir Starmer's speech today at the Labour Party conference, the final day of the conference in Brighton in the south of England. And look, this is a conference that happens every year, every September and into October. The political party conferences happen. And so Labour went first this year. I think it's normally the Tories. Well, I don't know. One goes first, the other one follows. And then there will be the Liberal Democrats, the Lib Dems, as they are known. Their party conference will be coming after the Conservatives finish theirs. And the Conservatives will have theirs next week. But the point is that I want to just play you just a portion. There'll be two portions, but this is the first of the two or three. Two small portions and one really small portion of Sir Keir Starmer's speech. And here it is. Roll tape.
Thank you so much, conference. I've waited 17 months, 25 days and 2 hours to appear in front of you in this hall as leader of our great party. and Doreen, thank you for your kind words. Thank you for everything you've done for criminal justice. Thank you for everything you've done for our party. I'm so proud to call you my friend. Thank you, Doreen. And conference, let me take this first opportunity to thank my brilliant Shadow Cabinet and Shadow Lords team for everything that they have done in the last 18 months. Thank you so much, colleagues. And Louise Ellman, welcome home. This hasn't always been an easy conference. Sunday was particularly nerve-wracking, but then the results started coming through. Arsenal 3, Tottenham 1. Conference, before I start, let me tackle the issue of the day head-on. If you go outside and walk along the seafront, it won't be long before you get to a petrol station that's got no fuel. Level up, you can't even fill up. And conference, doesn't that just tell you everything you need to know about this government? Ignoring the problem, blaming someone else, then coming up with a half-baked solution. Why do we suddenly have a shortage of HGV drivers? Why is there no plan in place? A tank of fuel already costs £10 more than it did at the start of the year. Gas and electricity bills up. Gaps in the supermarket shelves. Rent up, especially for those on the lowest incomes. Yet this is the very moment the government is putting up tax on working people, putting up tax on small business, and shamefully slashing universal credit, the lifeline for 6 million families. We have a fuel crisis, a pay crisis, a goods crisis, and a cost of living crisis all at the same time. Conference, let me quote to you what the Prime Minister said at the United Nations last week. We believe that someone else will clear up the mess we make because that's what someone else has always done. Well, Prime Minister, either get a grip or get out of the way and let us step up and clear up this mess. This is our first full conference since the 2019 general election, in which we suffered our worst defeat since 1935. To our devoted activists, to our loyal voters, I want to say loud and clear, you saved this party from obliteration and we will never forget it. Thank you. But my job as leader is not just to say thank you to the voters that stayed with us. It is to understand and to persuade the voters who rejected us. To those Labour voters who said their grandparents would turn in their graves but they couldn't trust us with high office. To those who reluctantly chose the Tories because they didn't believe that our promises were credible. To the voters, to the voters that thought we were unpatriotic or irresponsible or that we looked down on them. I say these simple but powerful words. We will never, under my leadership, go into an election with a manifesto that is not a serious plan for government.
And that was a direct rebuke of Jeremy Corbyn. Those last few moments of that portion of Sir Keir Starmer's speech today at the Labour Party conference in Brighton were clearly aimed at Jeremy Corbyn and any of his supporters, the Corbynistas. Now, look, I will say full disclosure, I supported Jeremy Corbyn when he was Labour leader. Now, there were some issues with Jeremy Corbyn. But generally speaking, I supported him. He has a long history of fighting for the right kinds of causes. But the problem I have is this aloofness, and a lot worse than aloofness, around anti-Semitism. He liked some posts that were anti-Semitic and all this kind of thing on Facebook, and he stood by. I mean, there's stuff like that that is a problem with Jeremy Corbyn and a number of other things, for which he had the whip removed from him by Sir Keir Starmer. The parliamentary whip was removed from him. So that meant that he could not sit with the Labour Party anymore and could not vote as a member of the Labour Party in the House of Commons. So when his vote would be given, it would go down as an independent vote. It would not be a vote with the party. So, you know, there's obviously some tension, and since that happened, Jeremy Corbyn, as I should say, Sir Keir Starmer, as the new Labour leader, has not restored the whip to Jeremy Corbyn, who is the previous Labour leader, who got trounced in the general election in 2019, which Sir Keir Starmer talked about, and that was such a horrible general election. With everything going on, Labour lost as badly as they did. And that part of the speech you just heard, with Sir Keir Starmer saying, "We will never, under my leadership, go into a general election with a manifesto that is not," and it basically said that is not realistic, that can't possibly be done in terms of the sake of governing. And that was aimed right clearly, squarely at Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, there's no way around it. And so, you know, he made it very clear to everybody in the room in Brighton, inside the room there, and I forget where it was, I think it was at the hotel, or wherever they were in Brighton, inside that auditorium, that he was not going to, the next general election that comes, is not going to have some pie-in-the-sky manifesto. And I remember at the time, just 2 years ago, when the Labour Party released its manifesto, there were people, some members of the Labour Party, who were grumbling about the manifesto, saying that it was quite unrealistic, saying that there's no way that half the stuff could even be done. There's no way that this is getting past anybody in the House of Commons when you're talking about voting in Parliament. And there were open grumbles about it. And this was in the run-up to the election. So there were some Labour Party members, mostly the left factions, if you will, who were happy with the manifesto, and then the moderate factions were not, and there was a lot of grumbling. And so this is what Sir Keir Starmer was talking about there, is that there's going to be a real, clear, solid, attainable vision and not some unrealistic pie in the sky. And so that's what that was. And you, obviously, you know, look, there's a lot of frost between the left and the moderates in the Labour Party. That's always been the case. And so Sir Keir Starmer, as leader, putting his stamp on the party, and I think that's what this speech was today, at least. You heard the first portion there, designed really for him to put his own imprimatur on the leadership. And as rocky as it's been for him, and the shuffling of positions, and Angela Rayner, who now has at least four positions and two really good, powerful ones, you know, he's had to do that. He's had to backtrack on a couple of things. He's had to tweak things at the conference, during the conference. He's had to yield to things that he didn't want to, that he was forced into, that he had to do. And I don't want to even go into all of those. But the bottom line is, for those of you who are not in the UK listening to this, Sir Keir Starmer is not only trying to remake the Labour Party, in my view, he's also trying to remake his own image, and not even so much remake his own image. Let me correct myself. He's trying to stamp his own vision on the Labour Party and stamp his own vision in that leadership role. And I think this conference gave him the opportunity to do that. And I think he did it with this speech. I think he did. Listen, it's one speech that he's given, the most important speech he's given thus far in his political career. And if he does become prime minister, of course, the most important will then be obviously the ones he gives as prime minister. But it's going to be an uphill battle for Labour. It really will. And I'll get into that a little bit in a few moments. But first, I think I'd like to take a break, but I will come back with something that you might find funny.
Today, I want to tell you how. Today, I want to tell you where my passions were born and why I'm in politics. There are two rocks in my life, the two sources of what I believe to be right and good: family and work. I'm not from a privileged background. My dad was a toolmaker, although in a way, so was Boris Johnson's. So many low-paid jobs. And when I tell you that good work and fair growth will be the priority for a Labour government, I haven't learnt this in some political seminar. I learnt it around the kitchen table. I learnt it at home from my dad. How pride derives from work. How work is the bedrock of a good economy. And how a good economy is an essential partner of a good society. That is why I am so proud to lead a party whose name is Labour. Don't forget it. Don't forget it. Labour, the party of working people. My mum worked incredibly hard too. She was a nurse in the NHS, and a very proud nurse too. I got from my mum an ethic of service. But my mum was also, unfortunately, a long-term patient of the NHS. When she was young, she was diagnosed with Still's disease. It's a rare form of inflammatory arthritis which severely restricts mobility. This disease, along with the drugs she had to take to control it, took a very heavy toll. The NHS, that had been her livelihood, became her lifeline. There were times, many times, when Mum was so ill that she had to go into hospital. I remember going into the intensive care unit one day, as I often did. Mum's bed was a riot of tubes and temperature devices. I could sense the urgency in the conversations of the four nurses on my mum's bed. I knew, without being told, they were keeping her alive. I can hardly convey to you the emotion of seeing your mum in that condition. And there was a sort of horrible irony in the moment. I'd just picked up an award for work I'd done on the death penalty, which in my own way was about trying to save people's lives. I'd gone to the hospital, hoping to tell my mum about it. And there, in front of me, those four nurses were working to save her life. When that long day was over, I thanked them for what they'd done. And they said to me, "We're just doing our job." And they were. They were doing their job for my mum that night, somebody else's mum the night before, somebody else's mum the night after. But that's not just a job, it's a calling. So when I think of the extraordinary dedication of doctors and nurses working to keep people alive as the COVID virus took hold, I know what that looks like. I understand what that means. So just as we stood on our doorsteps and applauded, let this conference ring out its approval to the NHS staff, truly the very best of us.
So that was Sir Keir Starmer talking about his mother and father, and particularly about his mother, at least in that clip, and the NHS, saluting the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, and of course in England specifically as well. Of course, England is part of the UK. The thing is that the National Health Service has been really destroyed by the Tories, essentially, with privatization efforts that have been done by Jeremy Hunt and Matt Hancock. And throughout the Tory reign and the regime of the Tories over the last 11 years, the Tories have done their level best through those two people I've just mentioned the names of and others to destroy the NHS and to gut the NHS and to privatize it. Jeremy Hunt is the one that has done, I think, a whole lot of the damage, most of it, the bulk of it. And austerity is the excuse, right? And so the Tories claim austerity and then they absolutely starve everybody while they and their rich buddies get lots of tax breaks. Sound familiar? This is the thing that happens. And, you know, Sir Keir Starmer there giving a very, I think, a poignant, heartfelt part of the speech there. And I'm not going to play any more excerpts because I want to actually leave it there. I will, because I just think it's important to get to hear some of the things that you don't get to see again in the corporate news media about the people that you think you know, the politicians specifically in this case. And Sir Keir Starmer comes across as this very somewhat stiff, a little wooden, maybe a little bland. And I hope that it came across in the portion of that particular speech that I played, that particular portion, I should say. I hope it came across that this guy actually is flesh and bone and actually does have a pulse. And actually does care, and it was very poignant to hear him talking about his mother and about how these four nurses took care of her as she was wired up to all these tubes and all the in the ICU and all the other things, and this really chronic illness that she had and arthritis. I mean, it's good to actually, it's not good to hear of that sad story, but it's good to actually see someone in a different light and are shown, be shown them in a different light. God, that's not good English. You know what I'm trying to say. And so it's good to see Sir Keir Starmer depicted in a different way. And on that stage in Brighton today, at the Labour Party conference, he delivered a speech I thought that was very good. And I just wish that these idiots did not heckle him. I didn't understand this. And it always seems to happen at Labour Party conferences. I mean, maybe it happens at Tory ones as well. But I just don't understand people who are heckling Sir Keir Starmer. I mean, are these Jeremy Corbyn Corbynistas? I mean, why is Sir Keir Starmer being heckled? I don't get it. I really don't. And yes, I think his tenure as Labour leader was rocky, has been rocky. You know, he had to deal with Jeremy Corbyn and the anti-Semitism issues and a number of other things that Labour have not been good on. And I think slowly but surely he's coming into his own as Labour leader. He suffered some setbacks. There have been some infights in the party. There have been some power struggles in the party. That always happens in Labour. That is not new, and it didn't just begin with Sir Keir Starmer's leadership. This has happened for decades in Labour, and the pendulum has always swung between the progressives and left and progressives versus the moderates, or not versus, but it's always swung between the progressives and the moderates in that party. That's the way that it goes. And now the moderates have control of that party. And you know, we had the uber moderates and people like Tony Blair, the Blairites, who really were, you know, neoliberals. And Sir Keir Starmer, I don't know that he is a neoliberal. I don't get the sense that he is that. I think he's just I think he is a moderate who is going to govern more center-left. I hate these assignations. Oh, centrist, center-left, you know. But hey, I'm saying it for the sake of this conversation or monologue with you, dear listener. And he's going to govern, should he ever become prime minister. He's going to govern from the center. That's very clear. But he's someone who I think he can be pushed. I think he's someone who can do the right thing and will do the right thing. And again, just some of the passion and heartfelt expressions there from that second portion of the speech that I played. It gets you an idea of who Sir Keir Starmer is as a person. So that's what I'm really driving at. So I thought it was good, that speech. He spoke for about an hour, I think. Something like that. Close to an hour. I forget the exact amount. Maybe even more than an hour. It went by really quickly. It was a very good speech. He articulated a vision. He reiterated what some of his Labour colleagues, fellow Labour colleagues, had said during the previous three or four days of the conference. The conference lasted 5 days from last Saturday through to today. And he talked about the importance of fighting climate change. He wanted Britain to become a healthier society, become the healthiest society on earth. He talked about, as you heard in the first clip that I played, the petrol shortages that have ravaged England now. And this is all Brexit and all about the bullcrap of Boris Johnson and the Tories. I mean, this is what's happened, you know, and I'm sure that people did not vote for Brexit to get this. I mean, I'm sure if they had been told the truth about what could happen, and the thing is, the corporate news media in England, through the Barclay brothers and all these billionaire magnates who are conservatives, they lied. They lied and lied relentlessly to you about what was going on and what Brexit was going to bring. And people just were in a state of, I don't care what it brings. I don't want the European Union in my business anymore. Whoa, kick them out. And that was the kind of xenophobic, racist provincialism that you were getting from some of the people who voted for Brexit. Now, there were other people who voted for Brexit who actually did not vote for it and think of, well, I don't want these black or brown people here. There are actually some people like that who actually do exist in England. But there were a great many people who did vote that way. And Nigel Farage, and you know who that is, some of you who are listening, If you don't, well, you don't really need to know. Nigel Farage was one of them who trafficked in the racism, who trafficked in, you have to hate these black and brown people. And if you vote for Brexit, you won't see them around here in England, in the UK. So why don't you go ahead and vote for it? Because we're at the breaking point, you see. He said, standing in front of a poster that said in big red letters the words breaking point and a photograph of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of olive and brown skinned people. In other words, to convey the idea that they're all coming to a town or hamlet or theatre or Old Vic near you. So Englanders, white Englanders, be careful. Do not do this because you're going to get the brown peril coming at you. Now, that's what Nigel Farage was doing. So this is the kind of toxic, racist, xenophobic, fear-mongering bullcrap that you can expect from Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage and the rest. Nigel Farage is a total failure. And he absolutely made millions of pounds off of what I call, it's not my phrase, what is called disaster capitalism. Something that Naomi Klein has written a lot about. The Shock Doctrine is one of her books. This is exactly what he has made lots of money off of, Nigel Farage. And Boris Johnson too has gained a lot of money out of this. And now petrol shortages. So Sir Keir Starmer is talking about all those things. In his speech today, he talked about National Health Service, as you heard. He talked about so many different things. And I just wanted to just boil down. That's probably about 10 minutes split over those two or three clips that I played, including, of course, the joke that Sir Keir Starmer told there about Boris Johnson and his dad, Stanley Johnson, who actually is an environmentalist, which is so interesting, you know. I mean, Boris Johnson, both of these guys are not particularly good or likable people. I think Stanley Johnson, jeez. Anyway, I don't even want to waste, I'm not wasting my time or yours talking about the Johnsons. So that's, because that's going to be next week, isn't it? Because the Conservative Party conference begins on Sunday, I believe it is. And it will be in Manchester, of all places. Goodness gracious me. Manchester's pretty much a Labour stronghold. But recently, there have been some developments in Manchester. There have been some Tory voters. And you never would have expected that in Manchester. But not to say that they've never had Tory voters. Of course, they've had Tory voters in Manchester. Just like they've had rain in Manchester. Rain in Manchester? Oh, never. Oh, that never happens in Manchester. I mean, come on. Rain, Manchester? Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Anyway, that's next week. And I won't be covering speeches, but I will be talking about, well, maybe I might. We'll see. But I just wanted to offer you, dear listener, a condensed edition of the speech there from Sir Keir Starmer, and the first part of that speech you heard, and then the joke, and then, of course, the last part where he really talks about the NHS, talks about his mother, a personal touch. And these hecklers, I'm sorry, these hecklers are so very rude. Here he is talking about his mother. His mother. And you've got hecklers interrupting, as you heard there. And by the way, they interrupted him a good few more times. I think when I played what I played there, over a 10-minute period split over two or three different clips, you heard, I think, two or three hecklers. There were several more. And they actually made reference to it again later on. You can heckle all you like. He made reference to the hecklers at least two or three. I mean, these hecklers are disgraceful. And what are you coming into the party conference for if you're going to keep interrupting speech? It's very selfish. It's very rude. And if you wanted to protest, why didn't you do it outside? But I get it. I sound like the kind of people who say, why are you blocking the bridge for Black Lives Matter? I sound like them now. Oh, God, I don't want to sound like them. They have a right to speak and even interrupt, but maybe they don't. It's kind of rude, you see. So they don't have a right to interrupt Sir Keir Starmer or anyone else who's speaking. Oh, dear. But again, you heard Baroness Doreen Lawrence introduce Sir Keir Starmer, and I thought that was very nice as well. And all the work that she has done over the years get justice for her son. But I just feel that it's really important to play portions of that speech, because the Labour Party has some big challenges ahead, and the next 2 or 3 years are going to be massive in the United Kingdom. And I really am very, very concerned about the way my native country is travelling, and it ain't travelling very well. You've got an authoritarian clown at number 10 Downing Street, surrounded by other authoritarians and sociopaths. And you've got someone at number 10 who just wants to sit at the throne of power. He doesn't want to do anything. And all he is doing, aside from sitting in the throne of power and being the sociopath that he is taxing the poor, is taxing the working class, and doing nothing about getting vaccines to the African continent. That is not even happening under Boris Johnson. You can forget it. He's not doing jack. And meanwhile, austerity running amok, universal credit being cut. And by the way, universal credit was created by a Conservative MP named Ian Duncan Smith, who makes a living sticking his finger in his nose, picking his nose, and putting it in his mouth. Sorry for being so graphic. I saw him do that on television, by the way. That's why I'm saying it. Sorry. Sorry for the visual. How can you be so disgusting? He actually, I think he's knighted. Or he's got an OBE or something. I think he's knighted. How'd a queen knight someone like him? Or give him an OBE or MBE? Oh, God. Member of the British Empire. Order of the British Empire. Baroness Doreen Lawrence is in the House of Lords, and she has an OBE. Ian Duncan Smith? Really? I don't think so. He's disgusting. He's really disgusting. But he's the guy that invented universal credit. And universal credit, thanks to Boris Johnson, is being cut. And it is a lifeline for people. I mean, it wasn't all perfect, but it was a lifeline for people. And the bottom line is that all of these services are being cut by Boris Johnson. You've got sociopaths and bullies surrounding him, Priti Patel, all these sick people. And the country's going down the toilet. You've got Brexit just destroying the country. It's a nightmare. I am very concerned. I'm not the only one. I know a lot of my fellow compatriots and country persons are very, very concerned about the direction of the United Kingdom. It is really dangerous. Trade deals that aren't going anywhere. You know, Biden just basically looked at Boris Johnson when he was out here in Cornwall, out in Cornwall in England, and just said, trade deal, what? No, we're not doing jack with you. It's like, Boris Johnson and him do not see eye to eye on some of these things. Trade deal? Well, what? We're not doing no side trade deal with you. Who the hell do you think you are? That's what Biden basically said to him. I mean, I'm just paraphrasing and putting my spin on it. But Biden has no time for this clown. He has no time for this guy. Oh, God. This guy is very dangerous. Boris Johnson is very dangerous. And it's going to be an uphill battle for Labour now. Because when this election, this general election comes in 2023 or 24, you've got these people passing voter ID laws. Sound familiar? Oh, you need to show your ID. Yeah, right. It was good before when you didn't have the show. Now you've got to show ID. What for? What for? I wonder. I wonder why the Conservatives want this law passed. Totalitarians. Bastards. Labour has an uphill battle these next 2 or 3 years. And we have to get on this. We have to push Labour as well. We have to support Labour. They're the only alternative, really meaningful alternative to what you've got happening. And we've got to get in there and get on board and fight on. And let's get behind the leadership and let's get behind the party specifically as well. And I'll give you some information about that and how to do it right after this. Welcome back. So I promised you some information. If you want to get involved with the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, don't forget, you've got to head to labour.org.uk. That's Labour, labour.org.uk. That's the website. Donate, get involved. There are Labour supporters abroad and things of that nature as well. So get involved. And yeah, please get involved, you know, because we've got to start doing this now. Because I'm telling you, England and the UK at large are in deep doo-doo. And we're seeing it already now with these petrol shortages and people brandishing knives and waving them at people in cars. And it's getting ugly. It's getting really ugly. Not that it hasn't been before. Of course it has. And throughout England's history and the UK's history. My goodness. But I'm telling you now, we have got to be serious about getting the Tories out of these seats. And the way to defeat Boris Johnson is to vote the Tory MPs out on the local level, because only the constituents of Ruislip and Uxbridge can get rid of Boris Johnson out of his seat. And not only do we want Boris Johnson out at number 10, we want the whole lot of them out. Because if the Tories gained enough seats to stay in power, but Boris Johnson lost his, all they'd do is put in someone else as prime minister. It probably would be Dominic Raab as the deputy prime minister. Dominic Raab. But the Tories would stay in power anyway. So what people have to do is have enough courage to get rid of these Tories out of these positions of power in their local MP seats. Get rid, please. That's where you break this. In your own district. Dagenham and Redbridge. I can just name all the districts in the UK, right? I don't know if there isn't a Conservative, if there's a Conservative MP in Dagenham and Redbridge. Maybe there's not. I doubt it. There's East London. Probably not. Because London's pretty much Labour country. But once you get to, I mean, even places like Watford, my beloved. Watford Town. Watford, they got some Conservatives. They got some Lib Dems there too. The mayor is a Lib Dem, Liberal Democrat. But you've got, once you start going north in some of these places, you know, forget it. Blue, blue, blue Tories, that is. And remember, Liverpool is the only real stronghold down the northwest of England that still is Labour stronghold. I mean, my goodness, a lot of these places, Hartlepool's turning freaking blue. Into what? And that's what Sir Keir Starmer's talking about too. We really have to work hard, because we're losing places we have no business losing. But the thing that's promising are these two by-election wins. One of them that was, although I think that was not a win for Labour, that was actually a win for the Lib Dems in Amersham and Cheshire, I think, or something like that. Amersham and Cheshunt, or I forget the name. I should know because it's not far. I should know what Amersham and Chalfont or what. But Amersham, I'll just say Amersham for now. The Lib Dems won a by-election there a couple months ago. And also a couple of months ago, and I chronicled it here on this podcast. And her last name just flashed out of my head. Oh yeah, got her name again now. Kim Leadbeater won the Labour seat in Batley and Spen in West Yorkshire, where her own sister, Jo Cox, sat in that very seat. And of course, you know what happened to Jo Cox. It was so horrible. She was murdered 5 years ago now. As she was seeing her own constituents in her surgery, and the surgery is her office. That's what that is in England. We call it surgery. And the surgery hours, office hours, and this piece of garbage right-wing Brexiteer bullshit artist, excuse me for cursing, I'm so sorry, came up and anyway, I just don't, it gets too graphic from there. And Jo Cox, you know, she had a great future ahead of her. Had a really, it's just horrible. And she was a member of Parliament and she was murdered. And so her sister Kim Leadbeater, won the by-election there in Batley and Spen this particular July that just went by. And I thought it was really good too. It may have been late, or it may have been early August, actually. But in any event, she did win. So that's promising. And if Labour can build on that kind of a victory and keep going, then there is hope. But it's going to be an uphill battle. And, you know, it's just going to be difficult. But there you go. Labour.org.uk. That's labour.org.uk. And don't forget on Twitter, UK Labour. That's UKLABOUR. And look, we need to get involved, because what's happening in England and what's happening in the UK at large is absolutely abominable. It really is. Something else that's abominable, but on a lesser scale, is what happened today at the House of Representatives. For the second consecutive day, the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman, the Defence Secretary, and the Chairman of Central Command all testified before a congressional body. Today, however, well, you know what happened, don't you? I'll fill you in right after this. Welcome back. And one thing really quickly, please get your flu shot. It is flu season. Flu season essentially begins in September, and we are right at the end of September, you know, one more day after this one. And then after that, we are into October. So flu season's here from now through April. So please get your flu shot today. Do not delay. You can walk in, if you're here in the United States, you can walk in to a local grocery store and get one, you know, a local drugstore, you know, your pharmacy. Walk in and get your flu shot. It's free of charge. Or, of course, if you are someone with health care and you're fortunate enough, like myself, to have it, you just walk into your health care place and walk into a clinic or walk into wherever, and they will take care of you. So make sure you get your flu shot and don't delay. Make sure you are fully vaccinated as well, because the last thing we need is an epidemic of flu and COVID. We already have the pandemic of COVID-19, and to have flu go along with that too, a severe flu season, and you know, some flu seasons are rougher than others, but I tell you, we can make it less rough if we all get our flu shot. And by the way, COVID-19 is going to be like this, as far as I'm concerned. The COVID-19 vaccination is going to be something that we're going to have to be getting every year. I mean, no one's seeing it yet. Listen to me do that horrible voice. I know some of you really can't stand when I do that. Oh, dear. But no one's saying it yet in positions of power and corridors of power. But I assure you, we'll be doing this because people just don't want to sacrifice anything. They don't want to put a cloth over their nose and mouth, and they certainly don't want to get the vaccination. So, all right then, we're going to have to freaking well do it like this every year. Jeez, because you guys, some of the people out here, oh God, you know? Oh God, I'm being oppressed. I've got to put a cloth over my mouth and nose. Stupid. Anyway, so this is going to end up happening with COVID. We're going to be getting vaccinations every year. I know there's a booster shot for those who have immunodeficient systems and serious, you know, immunodeficiencies. People in that situation, people who are in grocery stores, who are grocery store workers, I should say, people who are 65 and older, they all will be able to get their booster shot now. Now, for those others of you who have been fully vaccinated, you are eligible to get a booster shot 6 months after the second of your two vaccinations. Of course, if you are doing Johnson & Johnson, it's only one shot. So at that point, right, you are only dealing with 6 months after you actually got your shot. But with Moderna, well, Moderna hasn't got their booster shot ready yet. It's not been approved yet. It's not ready yet. So the only one that's available is Pfizer. And you must get the booster shot with the same company that you got your vaccinations with. So if you are a Moderna person, you've got to wait for the Moderna booster shot. And it will come. It will come. Pfizer is the only one that has one at the minute. So those of you who got Pfizer vaccinated with those two jabs, don't forget that you now will be able to get a booster shot because the Pfizer booster shot has been approved here in the United States, at least. And you have to measure it 6 months from the last vaccination shot that you got from Pfizer. So there you go. That's how that goes. And we're going to end up doing this every year. I mean, you know, they're not going to tell you that yet because they don't want to freak people out. But the point is there's nobody to freak out. What is freaking people out is these people who don't want to get vaccinated because I've got my beliefs and I don't want to do it. And I'll fight for them to the death, but I won't fight against police brutality. And I won't fight for justice for George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, but I'll fight for my beliefs about spreading a virus because I don't want to get vaccinated. So there. There we go. Don't get me going on that again. I did that yesterday. But we're going to end up doing this every year. I mean, listen, I'm not a doctor, but come on now. It's obvious. So anyway, get your flu shot today and don't forget to get vaccinated as well. Please, fully vaccinated. And please don't forget to wear a mask. Being fully vaccinated does not exempt you from wearing a mask. So please wear one and don't just put it on just before you're going into a store. Keep it on all day. I know for some people that's just too much. And someone's going to tell me, well, I have problem breathing. Well, I have problem walking around knowing that you don't have a freaking mask on. And even if you're fully vaccinated, you should be wearing one. Sorry, I am coming at you with my passion and outrage here. Come on, that's how you drive this virus underground, especially now. We're heading into the cold months of the calendar year. I know in some countries, it's never cold, you know? And in some countries, it's never hot. But we are in many, many places around the world, across the world, we are heading into the winter months. And people tend to be inside more in the winter. So please wear a mask. Please avoid these gatherings. As I said yesterday, or maybe didn't say it yesterday, but I would love to go and see the San Francisco Giants. I would love to go and see them in the playoffs. But I'm not going to do it even though they play outdoors because the prospect of me sitting in seats with people, not just the people I'm with going to the game, but the prospect of sitting with people, you know, 50,000 people in seats, even in the open air, I don't want to deal with that. Then you've got to leave the stadium and then that bottleneck of people and you're in a crowd waiting to get out of the stadium, waiting to get out onto the street and get home. And you're bottlenecked with hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people before the crowds eventually thin out half an hour later. And all that time you're outdoors, you're in close contact with people, even outdoors. That's still a risk. I wouldn't go anywhere near. So please, people, try to avoid these kind of gatherings. I know there's lots of things going on. I get emails all the time from some of the places that I was going to prior to the pandemic. And they're all opening again like nothing's happened. Like the pandemic's over. And it's like, hell no, it's not over. I'm sorry. I mean, I'd love to do all these things that I was doing before. But I don't want to catch this shit. Sorry, I cursed again. Sorry. I don't want to catch this. I don't. And I've seen on Twitter story after story after story of people who sacrificed everything for 18 months. And then they ended up catching this damn virus from somebody. And can you imagine? They did everything right, and someone gave this darn thing to him. I'm telling you, this is not a joke. And I hear politicians talking like this virus is done and dusted. It is not. It is very much here. There are more variants. I'm reading about them. It doesn't make for good reading. I mean, this is not good. And you got between the sociopath in England and... I mean, it's just terrible. We cannot let our guard down about this. And just because they're booster shots, that doesn't give you the invitation to throw your mask away. But, you know, that's how we're trained here in the United States. A quick fix solution. Oh, booster shot. I can toss this mask away. Bye. And that's not how we should be operating, but that's how our culture operates. Just get this quick fix and you'll be as right as rain. And that, I'm sorry, is not the code. It doesn't work. We're looking for quick fixes, and you can't with viruses because they aren't quick to be fixed. But they spread quickly. And if you throw your mask away, or if you take this lightly, you might end up with this horrible virus. And I know people, and I know some of you know people, very close to you, or people who you know and have known for a long time, who have this virus and they got long COVID. They can't smell a thing. They're aching all over every day. They're having trouble breathing. And they've been at it like this for 7 months, for 10 months, for a year. Come on now. We really have to take better care of ourselves and each other. So, look, today the House of Representatives, you had these three people, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Lawrence Lloyd Austin, Central Command leader, I think Michael McKenzie, I believe, or something like that. I forget his full name, And also you had Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley. And they all testified for a second day, this time in the House. Yesterday it was the Senate. And then they had a classified, you know, behind closed doors hearing testimony. And then, and now, you know, they had, today they had the House one. And the House Republicans were acting like the hyenas and the jackasses that we always know they are. And just embarrassing themselves. And, you know, Matt Gaetz being an idiot. You know, this guy should be behind bars. He's a criminal and a thug and shouldn't be anywhere near Congress. I mean, a load of these people, Scott Desjarlais, this is a guy who, you know, said he's, oh, I'm anti-abortion, right? Shouts at Republicans, shouts out that he's anti-abortion and proud of it. And then he cheats on his wife, of course, right? Gets the woman that he cheats with pregnant and then wags his finger. He does more than that. And gets very abusive with the woman that he's cheated with and impregnated and tells her, right then, you're going to get rid of that. Right then, you're going to get rid of it. You're going to get rid of it. You know, I mean, what a freaking piece of garbage he is. And thankfully, she said, no, I'm not getting rid of this baby. I'm not getting rid of this fetus. You're going to support me. You're going to support this child. Anyway, Scott Desjarlais, and he's sitting there questioning the Joint Chiefs Chairman and the Defense Secretary and the head of Central Command, CENTCOM, like nothing happened, like he didn't do anything. Like he didn't bully a woman and threaten her and abuse her after he impregnated her, after he cheated on his wife. Can we start with that, please? Start it for 10. Scott Desjarlais, Republican filth. I tell you, you know, there you go. And these are the people questioning, three people who served on the battlefields and sacrificed for this country. And these pinheads on the Republican side didn't care about getting answers to questions. They cared about talking about how many interviews President Biden did or how many books Mark Milley gave a quote to. Oh, please. They were more interested in Bob Woodward and Robert Costa's book, Peril, than they were about getting answers to their silly questions that weren't even about the things that the Democrats were asking. The only Republican who said something cogent was Liz Cheney. And no, I'm not giving her a pat on the back either, because her agenda is directly opposite to mine and ours. And she is someone who was against gay marriage. I think she still is. And her sister is gay. Mary Cheney. And Liz Cheney came out against her own freaking sister. So that shows you that. No, I am not going, hey, Liz, yay. No, not. I'm not doing it. I don't care that she didn't. That she treated them with respect. Good, great. But I'm not giving her a pat on the back or salute. She comes from the same primordial swamp that all these other people come from. She just does it more reasonably. Or whatever that word is supposed to be. Anyway, that's all we really need to know about that hearing. And each of the three gentlemen kept calm under fire. And this is about the Afghanistan withdrawal, and you think the Republicans would care about this. They don't care. They just want to grandstand for their base. I'll be right back with a closing, very sobering message. Welcome back. I want to end this edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast on this Wednesday with a very sobering message. And I will tell you who it is from afterwards, but this is something you should really listen to. And I want to warn you that it is particularly powerful and very vivid. I will explain, but I just want to read it. It is an impact statement. Don't get in the car, Sarah. Don't believe him. Run! Sarah is gone and I am brokenhearted. She was my precious little girl, our youngest child. The feeling of loss is so great it is visceral. And with the sorrow come waves of panic. And not being able to see her again. I can never talk to her, never hold her again, and never more be a part of her life. We have kept her dressing gown. It still smells of her, and I hug that instead of her. Sarah died in horrendous circumstances. I am tormented at the thought of what she endured. I play it out in my mind. Go through the terrible sequence of events. I wonder when she realized she was in mortal danger. I wonder what her murderer said to her, when he strangled her. For how long was she conscious, knowing she would die? It is torture to think of it. Sarah was handcuffed, unable to defend herself, and there was no one to rescue her. She spent her last hours on this earth with the very worst of humanity. She lost her life because Wayne Cousins wanted to satisfy his perverted desires. It is a ridiculous reason. It is nonsensical. How could he value a human life so cheaply? I cannot comprehend it. I am incandescent with rage. At the thought of it. He treated my daughter as if she was nothing and disposed of her as if she was rubbish. If Sarah had died because of an illness, she would have been cared for. We could have looked after her and been with her. If she had died because of an accident, people would have tried to help. There would have been kindness. But there is no comfort to be had. There is no consoling thought in the way Sarah died. In her last hours, she was faced with brutality and terror, alone with someone intent on doing her harm. The thought of it, is unbearable. I am haunted by the horror of it. When Sarah went missing, we suffered days of agony, not knowing where she was or what had happened to her. Then, when Sarah's burnt remains were found, we spent 2 terrible days waiting for tests to show how she had died, fearing she might have been set alight before she was dead. The thought was appalling. Burning her body was the final insult. It meant we could never again see her sweet face and never say goodbye. Our lives will never be the same. We should be a family of 5, but now we are 4. Her death leaves a yawning chasm in our lives that cannot be filled. I yearn for her. I remember all the lovely things about her. She was caring. She was funny. She was clever, but she was good at practical things too. She was a beautiful dancer. She was a wonderful daughter. She was always there to listen, to advise, or simply to share with the minutiae of the day. And she was also a strongly principled young woman who knew right from wrong and who lived by those values. She was a good person. She had purpose to her life. My outlook on life has changed since Sarah died. I am more cautious. I worry more about our other children. I crave the familiarity and security of home. The wider world has lost its appeal. It is too painful to contemplate a future without Sarah. So I just live in the here and now. I think of Sarah all the time. But the mornings and evenings are particularly painful. In the morning, I wake up to the awful reality that Sarah is gone. In the evenings, at the time she was abducted, I let out a silent scream. Don't get in the car, Sarah. Don't believe him. Run! I am repulsed by the thought of Wayne Cousins and what he did to Sarah. I am outraged that he masqueraded as a policeman in order to get what he wanted. Sarah wanted to get married and have children. Now, all that has gone. He took her life and stole her future. And we will never have the joy of sharing that future with her. Each day dawns, and I think Sarah should be here, leading her life and embracing new experiences. She has so many years ahead of her. I don't know how anyone could be so cruel as to take my daughter's life. What I do know is that Sarah will never be forgotten and is remembered with boundless love. I cling on to memories of Sarah. I hold them tight to keep them safe. The other night, I dreamt that Sarah appeared at home. In my dream, I held her and could feel her physically. Jeremy was there. We were comforting her, saying, "It's all right, Sarah, it's all right." I would give anything to hold her once more. I hope I dream that dream again. That was Susan Everard, mother of Sarah Everard. That was her impact statement, and that statement will be presented on Thursday, if it hasn't been presented already, during the sentencing hearing for Wayne Cousins, the now former Metropolitan Police officer and now convicted murderer and rapist of Sarah Everard. That is a really powerful and palpable statement. And I didn't warn you about it being graphic, but I have now obviously read out something that's also particularly graphic, so I apologize for not adequately warning you the way I should have. Very, very sad. Very, very painful. Very palpable and visceral. And I think only a mother can write something like that. And it's very painful indeed. And this time, Susan Everard and her family are definitely in my thoughts, as are the families of millions of other women and girls all across the world who go missing or who are raped and murdered or who are violated in some way, shape, or form, and very often do not ever come back home again. Wayne Cousins will be sentenced tomorrow, and he is expected to get the book thrown at him. And I hope that that is exactly what happens. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I am Omar Moore.